Chapter 52. The Matter in Greater Detail. Heidi said there was no cellular connection on the London subway, so Milgram hadn't bothered trying the dongle. The trip to Marble Arch had been a quick one, Milgram seated and Heidi standing, ceaselessly eyeing the other passengers for signs of incipient foliism. Heidi still had her jacket inside out. As she'd swayed in front of him on the balls of her feet, he'd been able to look up, the jacket repeatedly swinging open, and identify what he'd earlier taken for a brooch as having been three darts, the kind they played a game with here in pubs. He'd sometimes, on hotel television, glimpsed hypnotically tedious competitions that made golf seem like a contact sport. But now he understood what she'd done. There were two left. Not good. He supposed he should be grateful for her having done it under the circumstances, but still, ungood. Though he noted that he didn't find her frightening, however little he'd want to get on her bad side. There was a KFC adjacent the Marble Arch exit, he saw, as they emerged, but it was closed. It smelled horrible, and this struck him with some full and unexpected force of nostalgia and desire. Homesickness, he thought, another feeling he'd tamped down beneath the benzos, in whatever unventilated chamber of the self, however abstract the notion of home might be. But then Fiona pipped her bike's horn, twice, at the curb, gesturing to them. He walked over as she flipped her visor up, the particular angle at which the line of her cheekbone intersected the yellow helmet edge, striking him in some nameless but welcome way. "Coming with me," she said, offering him the black helmet, raising her chin slightly to make eye contact with Heidi, who'd come up beside Milgram. "I'll send a car for you." "Fuck it," said Heidi. "I'm walking. Where's Hollis?"
"At Cabinet. I'm taking Milgram."
"You do that," said Heidi, taking the black helmet and placing it on Milgram's head. The hairspray was still there. She gave the helmet a sharp rap with her knuckles in parting. Milgram threw his leg over the seat behind Fiona and put his arms around her, conscious of girl within the armor, blinking at the newness of that. Turned the helmet to see Heidi, dimly, through the miserable visor, marching away. Fiona put the bike in gear.
"Faggot above a load," said Big End, seated behind a very basic white IKEA desk. It had a broken corner and was stacked with books of fabric samples.
"Excuse me?"
Milgram was perched on a ridiculous violet stool, deeply and cheaply cushioned.
"Archaic expression," said Big End. "Faggots, properly speaking, being pieces of firewood. When one had a faggot above a load, one was about to drop one. It meant that something was excessive, too busy."
"Foley," said Milgram. "In the car in front of us."
"I gathered as much."
"Where's Aldous?"
"Being questioned by various species of police. He's good at that."
"Will he be arrested?"
"Unlikely. But when Fiona debriefed you in Paris, you told her that you'd gone to Galerie Lafayette, that Foley had followed you there, as you'd guessed he would, and that you'd slipped the Neo, having determined that Slight was using it to allow Foley to track you, into, I believe she said, a pram."
"Not a pram," said Milgram. "Exactly. More modern."
"Was there a reason for choosing that one particular pram?"
"The woman, the mother, was Russian. I'd been eavesdropping."
"What sort of a woman did you take her to be?"
"The wife of an oligarch, would-be oligarch."
"Or gangster?"
Milgram nodded.
"Accompanied by at least one bodyguard, I would imagine."
Milgram nodded. Big End stared at him.
"Naughty."
"I'm sorry."
"It isn't as though I don't want you to become more proactive," said Big End. "But now that I understand what you did, I see that you've been irresponsible, impulsive."
"You're impulsive," said Milgram, surprising himself.
"I'm supposed to be impulsive. You're supposed to be relatively circumspect."
He frowned.
"Or rather, not that you're supposed to be, particularly, but that I expected of you, on the basis of experience. Why did you do it?"
"I was tired of Slight, I never liked him very much.
One doesn't, agreed Big End. And I'd never really thought about the idea of his being able to track me with the Neo before. I'd taken that for granted, assumed it was something you wanted him to do, but then you were expressing distrust for him, suspicion.
Milgram shrugged.
I felt impatient, angry.
Big End studied him, the weird cathode blue of his suit seeming to float in Milgram's retina at some special depth.
I think I understand, he said. You're changing. They told me to expect that. I'll factor it in future.
He took an iPhone from an inner pocket and squinted at its screen, replaced it.
The woman in Seven Dials, the federal agent. I need to know more about that. All about it.
Milgram cleared his throat, something he tried never to do in situations like this. His bag was at his feet, the laptop in it, and now he resisted the urge to look at it. Winnie, said Milgram. Tongue Whitaker.
Why are you wearing the Sunny logo? Interrupted Big End.
Heidi bought it from a cleaner.
It's a Chinese brand, if one can call it a brand. Logo, rather. Used for the African market.
I don't think he was African. Slavic.
Jun? Called Big End. Come here.
A small man, Japanese, with round gold glasses, entered from the darkened shop. Milgram hadn't seen him when Fiona had ushered him in, only the other driver, the urine sample man.
Yes? Milgram needs some clothes. Put an outfit together. Would you mind standing, please?
Asked Jun. He wore a type of pointedly British hunting cap, Milgram thought by Kangol. Milgram associated it with the Bronx of another era. He had a small, very neat mustache. Milgram stood. Jun walked around him.
A 32 waist, he said. A 32 inseam?
33. He looked at Milgram's shoes.
8?
9, said Milgram.
British 8,
said Jun, and went back to the darkened front of the shop, where Milgram knew the urine sample driver was sitting with his umbrella.
She's not interested in you, Milgram said. She thought you might be Gracie's business partner. She had no way of knowing what she was watching in Myrtle Beach, so she followed me back here. And I think...
Yes?
I think she wanted to see London. Big End raised an eyebrow. But the police, authorities, wouldn't really help her much with you. She said you were connected with them.
Really?
But they asked her about your truck.
Asked her what?
They were curious about it.
But what did she want from you?
She'd thought that by learning more about you, she'd learn more about Gracie, about Foley. But as soon as she learned that you were just a competitor, that you were interested in U.S. military contracts yourself, she stopped being interested in you.
You told her that?
And she stopped being interested in you, repeated Milgram. There was a silence.
I see what you mean, said Big End.
I wasn't volunteering information. I was responding to specific questions. I didn't know what else to do.
Jun returned, his arms full of clothing, which he put down on the desk, pushing the fabric samples aside. There was a pair of very new, very bright brown shoes. Stand, please.
Milgram stood.
Remove jacket.
Milgram unzipped the sunny and took it off. Jun helped him on with something made of fragrant tweed, immediately removed it, tried another, equally fragrant, walked around, buttoned the jacket, nodded.
But why didn't you tell me this at the time? Asked Big End.
Remove trousers, please, said Jun, and shirt.
I was too anxious, said Milgram. I have an anxiety disorder.
He sat down on the horrible stool and began to remove his shoes. Taking them off, he stood and began removing his pants, grateful to have something to do.
I didn't make her follow me. You sent me to Myrtle Beach.
You may have an anxiety disorder, Big End said, but you're definitely changing.
Remove shirt, please, said Jun.
Milgram did.
He stood there in black socks and underpants from Galerie Lafayette, with a peculiar awareness of something just having shifted, though he wasn't clear what. June had been busy unbuttoning and unfolding a Tattersall shirt, which he now helped Milgram into. It had a spread collar, Milgram saw, and as he was buttoning the front, he discovered that the barrel cuffs extended nearly to his elbows, with a great many pearl buttons.
"Have you been to Florence?"
asked Big End, as Milgram was fastening those very peculiar cuffs.
"Florence?"
June had just handed him a pair of whipcord trousers.
"Tuscany," said Big End, "is lovely. Better this time of year. The rain. More subtle light."
"You're sending me to Italy?"
"Along with Hollis. I want you both out of here. Someone is angry with you. I'll generate deep blue ant traffic to the effect that you're both in Los Angeles. Perhaps that will convince Oliver."
Milgram heard that scream outside a bank station, took a breath, but found that no words came. He zipped up his new pants, which were oddly narrow in the ankles, and cuffed.
"Sit, please," said Jun, who was loosening the laces of the brown shoes. They were wingtip brogues, but with a narrower toe than was traditional, and thick, cleated-looking soles.
Milgram sat. Jun knelt, helped Milgram on with the shoes, then tightened the laces and tied them. Milgram stood, shifting his weight. They fit, he decided, but were stiff, heavy. Jun handed him a narrow, heavy leather belt of a similar shade with a polished brass buckle. He put it on.
"Tie,"
said Jun, offering one in paisley silk.
"I don't wear them, thanks," said Milgram.
Jun put the tie down on the desk, helped Milgram into the jacket, then picked up the tie again, folded it, and tucked it into the jacket's inside breast pocket. He smiled, patted Milgram on the shoulder, and left.
"That's better," said Big End. "For Florence. Bella figura."
"Am I going back to Camden?"
"No," said Big End. "That was why I had you give Fiona your key. She's gone round to pick up your things, check you out."
"Where am I going?"
"You aren't," said Big End. "You're sleeping here."
"Here?"
"A foam mattress and a sleeping bag. We're just around the corner from Blue Ant, but they don't know."
"Know what?"
"That I'm Tanky."
"What does that mean?"
"Tanky and Tojo, name of the shop. I'm Tanky, Jun's Tojo. He's amazing, really."
"He is?"
"You look," said Big End, "like a fox-hunting spiv. His grasp of contradiction is brilliantly subversive."
"Is there Wi-Fi?"
"No," said Big End. "There isn't."
"What she most particularly wanted to convey to you," Milgram said, Winnie Tongue Whittaker, "is that Gracie believes you're his competitor, which means to him that you're his enemy."
"I'm not his enemy," said Big End.
"You had me steal the design of his pants."
"Business intelligence. If you hadn't thrown Foley under some random Russians, this would all be much easier. And it wouldn't be distracting me from more important things. I am, however, glad that we had this opportunity to discuss the matter in greater detail, privately."
"Bent cops are one thing," said Milgram. "A bent former major in the Special Forces who does illegal arms deals? I think that might be something else."
"A businessman. I'm one myself."
"She said he believes he can do anything," said Milgram. "She said they sent him to schools."
"He wouldn't be my first arms dealer, you know," said Big End, getting up.
He straightened his suit, which Milgram noted was in need of a pressing.
"Meanwhile, you and Hollis can do the museums, enjoy the food. It's extraordinary, really."
"The food?
What they managed to do with you in Basel. I'm really very impressed. I see now that it's all taken a while to gel."
"That reminds me," said Milgram.
"Of what?"
"I'm starving."
"Sandwiches," said Big End, indicating a brown paper bag on the desk. "Chicken and bacon, seedy bread.
I'll be in touch tomorrow when the travel's been arranged. You'll be locked in here. The alarm system will be activated. Please don't try to leave. Jun will be in at 10:30 or so. Good night.
When Big End had gone, Milgram ate the two sandwiches, carefully wiped his fingers, then removed his new shoes, examined the Tanki and Tojo logo stamped into the orange leather insoles, smelled them, and put them on the white desk. The gray vinyl floor was cold through his socks. The door to the front of the shop, which Big End had closed behind him, looked cheap, hollow core. He'd once watched a dealer called Fish chisel the thin wooden skin from one side of a door like that. It had been filled with plastic bags of counterfeit Mexican Valium. Now he pressed his ear against this one, held his breath. Nothing. Was the urine sample man still sitting out there, with his umbrella? He doubted it, but he wanted to be sure. He found the light switch, pressed it, stood for a moment in darkness, then opened the door. The shop was lit, but dimly, by wonky columnar lanterns of white paper, floor lamps. The display window, from here, looked like one of those big cyberchromes in an art gallery, photograph of a blank brick wall across the street, faint ghost of graffiti. Suddenly someone passed, in a black hoodie. Milgram swallowed, closed the door, turned the lights back on. He went to the rear, no longer bothering to be quiet, opened a similar but smaller door, finding a clean little room with a very new toilet and corner sink. No other doors, no rear entrance. The neighborhood, like much of London, he guessed, not having alleys in the American sense. He found a virginal white slab of foam, 5 inches thick, double-wide, rolled into a thick, upright cylinder. It was secured with 3 bands of transparent packing tape, the Blue Ant logo repeated along them at regular intervals. Beside it was a fat, surprisingly small sausage of what appeared to be a darkly iridescent silk and a plastic liter bottle of still spring water from Scotland. The desk's top drawer contained its IKEA assembly instructions and a pair of scissors with colorless transparent handles. The other 2 drawers were empty. He used the scissors to cut the tape, releasing the foam, which remained slightly bent in the direction in which it had been rolled. He put the concave side down on the cold vinyl and picked up the silken sausage. Mont Bell was embroidered on one side. He fumbled with the plastic lock of the draw cord, loosened it, and worked the densely compacted contents out. The sleeping bag, when he unfurled it, was very light, very thin, stretchy, and of that same iridescence, purplish black. He unzipped it and spread it on the bed. He picked up the bottle of water and carried it to the desk, where he retrieved his bag from the floor, putting it beside the bottle. Taking Big End's chair, he sat down, opened the bag, and pulled out his crumpled cotton jacket. He looked down at the tweed lapels of his new one, surprised to see them. The shirt cuffs were too strange, but then you couldn't see them under a jacket. Laying his old jacket aside, he brought out the Mac Air, its power cord and UK adapter plug, and Hollis's red dongle. British electricity was some brutal other breed, their plugs 3-pronged, massive, wall sockets often equipped with their own little switches, a particularly ominous belt and suspenders touch. "Faggot above a load," he said, plugging the power unit into the socket nearest the desk and flipping the socket switch. He googled Tanki and Tojo, shortly discovering that Junya Marukawa, had his own shop in Tokyo, that Tanki and Tojo were getting lots of web coverage, and that a Soho branch would be opening next year on Lafayette. There was no mention of Hubertus Big End at all. Jun's style, evidently, was one Japanese take on something at least one writer called transgressive trad. Then he went to Twitter, logged in, saw that there was nothing new from Winnie, and started composing his message to her in his head. While he got rid of the 3 strange girls with numbers instead of surnames, the ones who wanted to follow him.